Is that working, Tiz? Oh, yeah, that's good. I can hear the sound. So what I was hoping to do this morning is talk a bit about my reading of what Pope Francis is saying in The Joy of Love. And I suppose I'm doing that with two hats. I've been involved in youth ministry and adult religious education and community development all my adult life. So from that perspective, I'm interested. But also, I've been married 35 years and reared a family. And I'd be trying to speak out of that family experience. So that's what I'd hope I'll be doing. And the way I'd hope to do it is maybe to start on something on the reality of family life, just swapping a few stories, just that you'd have a sense of the context that I'm coming from, but also to give you a chance to name that for yourselves. And then we'll see what is it that Pope Francis is saying about the realities of our family lives. So that's what I'm hoping anyway. But maybe to start, Martin is my name. I'm from Limerick originally, but I'm living now in Cavan. I married a Cavan woman, and we spent a good bit of our lives in the Midlands, but eventually she got me up to Killeshandra, where I came from this morning. And any time when I'm going around the country, if I tell anybody I'm from Cavan, they insist on telling me stupid Cavan jokes. And yes. Well, I was down in Holy Cross at the Novena. I'd had my breakfast, minding my own business, and there was a priest sitting across the table from me, and he looks across at me and he says, "Hi," he says, "tell me this, what does a cow about to give birth have in common with the people of Monaghan?" Eh? He says, "I don't know, what does a cow about to give birth have in common with the poor people of Monaghan?" Oh, he says, "they're all near Cavan." And he roared laughing. That's what I have to be putting up with. But anyway, I just want to maybe just share something, some images and some stories from my own family background as a way of entering into this conversation on faith and family, and give you a chance just to see that they spark any images or stories for yourselves, and you can be chatting there among yourselves. I suppose to say I started life as the eldest of a family of eight. So my father worked in a factory in Limerick, and by the time I was seven, I was already the eldest of six. And my mother, to organise life in the house, kind of grouped us. So if there was, say, a thing like the Saturday night bat, she'd divide us into two groups, the big ones, she called us, and the small ones. So we were the big ones, the first three, and the small ones were the second three. And life was kind of organized around the big ones and the small ones. And actually, it's funny the way things work out. Like, that's 50 years ago, but the big ones still are quite connected. Now, all the family, all of us that are still there are still connected, but the three big ones especially, we'd like my brother and sister who are next to me would come up a lot to my house, and I'd see a lot of them. So that was a memory from a long time ago, and all of us, six of us, married. And one got divorced. And so the lad that got divorced is living on his own now, but he'd spend a lot of time traveling between the houses, you know, because that's kind of where his family. And he's very interested in cross-country walking. And a lovely image I have of our family from recent times, he went down to Limerick and he gathered up about 12 of the family, that's the brothers and sisters and some of their kids, and they went cross-country walking. Now, it was in desperate weather, but there's a photo at home of the brothers and the sisters and their kids all on that family walk. And that's a lovely image for me of family. And we, like, I suppose we've it wasn't that easy. Like I said, my father wasn't earning a big wage, so we had, you know, it was a struggle enough. But we did hold together. My father wasn't a very religious man, but he still, I think he communicated something to me anyway around values. I remember at Christmas time, one of the things we loved about Christmas was we used to get presents from other relatives and from visitors, a box of biscuits, boxes of chocolates. Now, there'd never be a box of biscuits or a box of chocolates in our house until Christmas, and they'd never last very long. But what we used to love watching was, in the weeks coming up to Christmas, the pile of biscuits and chocolates would be climbing higher. We used to love counting them. And one day, shortly before Christmas, we were all sitting in the sitting room watching the telly, and my father came in. He said nothing, but he grabbed one of the boxes and put it under his arm. And we were shocked. And he said, off he went out the door, and off he went out to the house. So we gathered at the window to look at him heading down the road with the box of biscuits under his arms, our box of biscuits. And we were wondering, where in the name of God is he going with it? And down at the bottom, we could see from where we were standing in the fields, there's a big open green at the bottom of our estate, there was a traveller camp. And we could see after my father. And he went to the traveller camp and he knocked on the door. They opened the door. He offered the box of biscuits. They took it and the door was closed. And he came up. And he never said a thing. But I've never forgotten that. I've never forgotten that moment. Because the boxes of biscuits were a treasure to us. And there he was, having given away some of our treasure. So that was an interesting moment for me. Another moment I remember, my mother was, my father wasn't religious, you know, in the sense of advocating we say our prayers or go to church or anything like that. My mother was. And she'd always be on to us to be saying our prayers. And one day, I remember she was in a panic. I was quite young at the time, I'd say. I was maybe 7 or 8. And she couldn't find some sort of an official form she needed for the dispensary. And she says to me, she says, pray to St. Anthony, she says, and I'll find it. And she was near in tears. So I said the best prayer I could to St. Anthony. And straight away, my mother shouted, I found it. Now, that was a huge thing for a 7-year-old to discover the power of prayer. And I've never forgotten it, you know, in a way that if somebody taught that to me about the power of prayer, but it was kind of a practical experience of it. So that's another moment that, even though that happened 55 years ago now, I still remember it vividly. So that was kind of, you know, life went on normally for, you know, but we've had our sadnesses and our losses. And of the 8 of us, one brother died at 21. And that never, ever, and I know that any of you that have lost family members, it doesn't go away, you know. And in some ways, for me, the sense of loss is positive because it's a way of remembering. But anyway, that was just part of, and I'd say it's partly as well what has held us together, like the brothers and sisters, you know, that we look out for each other. And I was given a diagnosis of cancer there a few years ago. And she said, God, they were all over me. It was like, and a gang of them came up to visit me anyway, and we took a picture. And you never saw such a funereal looking picture of the family in your life. So I still have it, but thank God I'm well again. And I just have that memento of that picture. Anyway, so that's kind of, those are just some images, some memories of my family of origin. And my family that I'm with now, the married breed 35 years ago. And shortly after we were married, we had the chance of doing some study in the States. We were both come from a ministry background. And we're interested in doing a bit of theology. So we got the opportunity to study full-time for a few years. So off we went. And we had our first child while we were there. And one of the things I remember, it disrupted our study regime, because we were normally both going to the same classes, you know, and now somebody had to stay home with the baby. So we shared that. And every day, I remember, there were three kinds of tasks that needed to be addressed. There was baby work, which had to be done, like the baby had to be fed and changed and so on. There was housework, like somebody had to cook the dinner. And there was schoolwork, there was always essays. And I remember I could only ever manage two out of the three in any one day. The baby had to be fed, so I either got the housework done or I got the schoolwork. But I remember Breda, she always managed the three out of three. And that was an early lesson for me in women's capacity to multitask, certainly better than I could anyway. And when we came back, we moved into our first home. I'd say Matthew was maybe five or six. And it was an old cottage, but it had high ceiling. And I remember thinking, gosh, I could build him a loft. And now I'm useless with my hands. And it took me forever to design the loft and to build it. And I was like a madman doing it, you know. I just had a ferocious energy for building the loft. And when I built it, I recognized it. And I recognized where the energy had come from. When I was a young fella, as I said, there was eight kids in the small house. And one of the places I used to love going to was my grandmother's. And she lived out in the back of beyonds, way out the country. But I loved it. And I loved the quiet. And I loved the chance to go out in the fields. And there was a loft, of course, in her house. They had built it over the kitchen. And that was my bedroom. And I used to love that room because you could hear the noises going on in the kitchen. You know, as a small young friend, there was something very comforting and something very peaceful about that room. And I suppose what struck me when I saw the loft I'd built me young fella, that I was trying to recreate, you know, I wasn't conscious, but I was trying to recreate the safe space that I had as a child. So that image stayed with me. And then maybe another story, and I'll finish with these then. But years later anyway, that young fella, Matthew, he's a grand young fella, but he didn't find school easy. And both myself and Breed were both self-employed. We don't easily fit into systems, and he didn't either. And by the time he was in sixth class, he was in trouble in school. So the first time he got into trouble, he says, "Can I leave?" And he says, "Okay, we'll get you another school." Now, there weren't too many schools where we were living, but we got him another school, and he got into more trouble, and he was very stressed. And me and Breda had to sit down to see, you know, how will we deal with this? And we asked him, "Matthew, would you like to leave school? You know, would you like to take a break from school, you know, and maybe take a job and then, you know, come back when you're ready?" And he said yes. He said yes, and we said fine. He said, "You know, you can look for a job." And he did. He got a job very fast. But not only did he get a job, he got a flat for himself. Now, he wasn't 17. You know, he wasn't 17. He was quite young. And and I remember one day going into town, we'd stay in touch with him. You know, we were nervous. We weren't sure we were doing the right thing. But I remember going into town one day, and I met a friend, and he says, "I seen your young fella," he says. He was Tumming. I didn't know where my young fella was coming from or going to. You know, and I felt, as a parent, very unsure of my ground. But we said to Matthew anyway, that was our sense that given a bit of scope. And our sense was that probably was the better thing to do, but we weren't sure. But anyway, he came back to us after months, and he said he'd like to get his leaving cert. He'd like to go back. He'd 1 year to complete. And so we had to look for the third school. If that one didn't work out, we were in trouble because there was near another one, but it did. We asked him, "Matthew, could you keep your head down for the year as best you can?" And he did, and he got through. And the day he finished his leaving cert, he moved out again. and he got a job in the buildings and worked away. And we said to him, Matt, if you'd ever like to go to college, because you knew he was bright, we knew that, you know, that he would do well in college, and that probably the buildings wouldn't be a lifetime work for him. But we said to him, you know, if you're ever interested in going back to college, give us a shout and we'll support you. But anyway, he stuck at the buildings in Ireland, and when the crash came, he emigrated to London and stayed in the buildings. And then one Christmas he was at home and he was telling us all the reading he was doing. He says he loved philosophy and he loved psychology and all that. And immediately Breda copped that he, in a roundabout way, he was saying he'd love to go. He was ready now for college. So before he left for Christmas back to London, he was booked into a college for that autumn. And fair play to him, he went back and he stuck it out, and he ended up working in psychiatric care. Now Breda figured he'd be a one side or other of that system anyway. But of course, sure enough, he was working in the system for a few years, and then no more than ourselves, he got out of that. So he's self-employed in psychiatric work at the minute. So those are some stories, and maybe just a final image to leave you with. Myself and Breda now are on our own, I suppose I'd have to say, and I'm not boasting when I say this, but our marriage has worked out, you know. And when I'll be talking afterwards about what Pope Francis is saying, like Francis is saying that a love that lasts is possible. That's my own experience, you know. I mean, we had to work at it, but it has worked out, and we've kind of grown with each other and to each other over the years. But the image that I love, that kind of captures for me what our marriage is like, is that we both love fishing. And because we're in Killeshandra, we're surrounded by water, so there's a boat at the end of our field that we can hop out and fish. So we'd be out there, we'd be catching nothing, and we'd be saying nothing. That's just sitting there, the two of us, one at either end of the boat, two rods out in the water. And for me, it's a lovely image, you know, that we don't need to be talking, and we're at ease in each other's company and enjoying each other's company. So that's just an image of married life that I'd like to leave you with. Okay, so I just wanted to start by sharing some stories that have shaped my experience, and I'd invite you to be quiet for a minute and just to see, do those stories or those images spark anything, any memory for you, any memory from your own experience of family. Now, just insofar as you're comfortable, I'd invite you to chat to your neighbour. Say hello to the person next to you, especially if you don't know them. And just then, if you have a story that was sparked for you about your own family experience, your own family memories, just share it and give them a chance to share as well. Just checking, anybody, any comment or observation on what you've been chatting about? What's that, times? Times past, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah. Brought back a lot of memories, yeah, yeah. One second, I'll give you this.
She's going to buy a fishing boat for herself and her husband.
She's going to find a fishing boat for herself and her husband. Good. Anybody else? Any observations?
You brought to the fore the importance of family relationships and family bonding. And sometimes we forget about those. So they're very important.
They are. And like one of the things we'll be looking at is that they're important to everybody, whether they're church people or not. It's the central Irish value. So we'll be talking about that. But when we belong to a network of relationships that are loving, it lifts our whole lives. And when we don't, when we lose them, or when they get broken anyway, it's devastating for folk. And that there's something very significant in that, you know, when we're talking about family and the joy of love and the world meeting the families even, that we're tapping into something that's very deep in our culture. Good. Any other observations then before we...
We had a bit of a chat here, and we're sort of saying that family life is sometimes a fierce struggle, and maybe, it would be important to acknowledge that, there are all sorts of problems that people can have, financial health problems, mental health maybe, or whatever, and then relationships, like, sometimes are very raw. And sort of try to acknowledge that and fit it into the call to love one another. That's what we're having the chat about. That.
Good. That makes sense. Yeah, that family life is very good, but it can be very, very painful, very, very difficult. And that's probably all our experience. It's not either or. So we'll be tapping into that and seeing what Pope Francis has to say about that as well. Okay. Is somebody with their hand up there yet?
Yeah, I thought it was when you talked about your son, like, I thought it was lovely, like, that within families there's going to be always difference, and the way you kept, and yourself and your wife kept, the relationship together when there was kind of difficulties or stormy waters, that was fantastic, because possibly at the time, if you were to look sometimes for help from others, maybe even close by, you were probably being told something else to do, but it's wonderful how, the whole thing knitted together and obviously... your son went on to, find what it was he wanted to do, which was the first thing, school and the academia side of things won't be for everyone, but it's always about finding the path by some other means, So I thought that was one of the things that struck me that was very powerful.
And we genuinely weren't sure it was the right thing, and I'd say an awful lot of times families are like that, that they're going by intuition, they're going by best judgment without being sure, because we got no training course in how to handle that situation.
Thanks, Martin. Your story of your father with the box of biscuits really struck a chord at me, in the sense that when I lived in Dublin, all those years ago, we lived in sheer poverty, and we would drink out of jam jars and milk bottles. But yeah, the community, everyone gave. Like, if someone wanted a bit of dripping or a bit of sugar or stuff like that, everyone sort of gave. And it just reminded me of the early Christian community, the way they lived. Like, everyone gave out of their own poverty. And your story really stuck with me, in the fishing boat and stuff, whatever. In the sense that myself and my ex-wife now, sadly, we bought a kayak a good few years ago because our marriage was going through a rocky patch. And we had actually got to see a counsellor over in Westport. And on the way home, we bought a kayak and we took it out to the lake of Gurtagani. And we actually prayed on that lake. It reminded me of the Sea of Galilee. And we actually prayed that, that the Lord would sort of recommit, we bless the marriage. And it was lovely. So, I was sort of envious of you in the boat with the wife, because sadly, there's no one in the boat anymore, whatever, but, that the marriage has actually broken up and stuff, whatever. And I suppose, as Breeze McKenna says, miracles do happen, so you never know. But it was lovely just to listen to it, and it just gave me hope.
Thank you. Thanks, Martin. Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, so good. So the reality is there for us, and we've seen it at first hand, I'm sure, in all our families, that the good times and the bad times, and sometimes things work out well and sometimes they don't. And I suppose the thing that strikes me about Pope Francis is that he's very clued in on that, and that while I think he's doing two things that I'd like to explore, he has a very powerful vision for marriage and for family and for love, which is not, he's not afraid or reticent about offering. So vision is very strong, and at the same time he's a deep sense of compassion for the, for the lives and the circumstances of people, and an understanding that for all sorts of reasons, things don't necessarily work out, and that we need to keep including folk who do not achieve, if you like, the ideal, and that working out that is a powerful, it's a powerfully positive task, but nonetheless it's a task. So will we go on to Francis just to see what he has to say anyway, and we'll be coming back then to connect it back to our own experience. And I'm just wondering, I have a short video clip here of Pope Francis talking about family at the World Meeting in Philadelphia. You wouldn't have seen that, I'd say, would you? No. I might just show it, and it's only a couple of minutes, but you know, he has a good sense of humour about it as well. Now, Danny was just checking, he has the heating on. Is it too warm or is it comfortable? It's comfortable, okay, so he won't turn it off yet. Okay. All right, Danny, so you might don't do the lights anyway. So this is from Philadelphia 3 years ago. You'd be aware that the World Meeting of Families is coming to Dublin next year. So you'll just get a sense, and Francis is in the middle of this. It takes about 5 minutes.
There's two pieces to this. You've got a Congress, which could be one of the largest conventions in Philadelphia in 2015, and that fills every square inch of the Pennsylvania Convention Center. And then you've got the papal visit, the weekend.
When you're dealing with an event this size, though, every plan has to interact. Everything has to interlock. Because if you don't look at everything from the global perspective, then the little parts aren't going to work right.
Can we get started?
Yeah, sure. Okay. All right, so we have the convention app is going to start up this week. The visitor app is pretty much set.
On the Congress side, we finalized our languages for all the presenters, sent that out to you guys in communications.
We have 5,400 that are eligible to volunteer, 3,000 that have already signed up.
Can we get in on a meeting with Scott a little bit about Festival of Families and what's coming, and so that we can help support that and understand that?
I'll invite you in.
Thanks.
So the stage is going to stay where the stage is, right? Mm-hmm. And so the first issue is it doesn't fit. We need all this for Saturday.
We have 81 sessions, and about a third of those are panels, and then half of the presenters are from outside of North America.
Thank you all. God bless you all.
It's so important to just focus on all the challenges that families are having, raising the kids and teaching the values.
Claro, algunos de ustedes me pueden decir,
some of you might say, of course,
Padre,
Father,
usted habla así porque es soltero.
You speak like that because you're not married.
Familias discutimos.
Families, we quarrel.
Las familias a veces vuelan los platos.
And sometimes plates can fly.
En las familias, los hijos traen dolores de cabeza.
And children bring headaches.
No voy a hablar de la suegra.
I won't speak about mother-in-laws.
Pero en las familias siempre, siempre hay cruz, siempre.
But in families, there is always light.
Go forth, the Mass is ended.
God bless you.
You all, thank you very much for your participation and for your love for the family. And I ask you pray for me. Don't forget.
Do us an great experience for me and my entire family. I have three kids and we all came here to see Pope Francis. And he is an amazing man. He is our Holy Father. We experience that holiness radiating from him. And we believe that it transformed the way we lead our family life.
Dear families, it is a great joy for me to announce that the Holy Father has decided that the next World Meeting of Families will be held in 2018 in Dublin, Ireland.
Okay, so we'll be hearing later on from folk in the diocese just about the preparations that'll be going on here in regard to the World Meeting of Families. So all right. So what I'm going to try and offer now is just a reflection on Pope Francis's take on family and setting it in context. And I'm speaking not as a theological expert. There'll be a lot of people here in this room who'd know a whole lot more theology than I know. But I'll be trying to speak out of my experience of ministry on the ground. And also my experience as a family man. So one of the things when I was going around the country, kind of consulting people in dioceses about the putting on some resources for parishes to do with the joy of love, there was a lot of anxiety. Folk were saying that as church, we're hardly very credible, you know, in speaking about families, because the time I was going around, the Tuam babies story was very much in the media, you know, and people were feeling quite insecure. And yet Pope Francis is so positive, so strong about the potential for mission today, including mission about family. And there was a lovely homily by one of the hierarchy in Ireland, and he was reflecting on the challenge and naming what for him was the difficulty, and he used a lovely metaphor. Now that screen isn't very bright, but that's Croke Park there, and he says, "We could hardly now present more than a respectable challenge at club level, and we're being told to prepare for Croke Park." So that's local perspective, and if an archbishop can say that and can feel that, then so can we. You know, that a sense, gosh, are we up for it in our parishes for the challenge of mission? Can we make any impact on the culture at all? So I mean, I think we have to be honest with ourselves with that question, and I'll just go on. There's I just had to. Yeah. There's a guy, he's an historian, and I'm not an historian no more than a theologian, but I like reading. And so this guy, Toynbee is his name, he did a big, big study on the rise of civilizations down through history. And he's asking the question, what is it that enables civilizations to flourish? Like, why do some flourish and others not? And what he said, you can see it up there, that civilizations arose in response to some set of challenges of extreme difficulty when creative minorities devised solutions that reoriented their entire society. It's a very interesting idea. Like he's saying, it wasn't despite the challenges that the civilizations flourished. It was precisely because of them that the challenge focused energy, focused imagination, focus creativity in a way that enables the community being challenged to respond effectively. And I think there's something in that perspective for us, that as faith people, our question isn't whether God's Spirit is active, but where? Where? And can we have the patience, can we have the calmness, can we have the resilience to keep exploring the question of how the good news of the gospel can be communicated to our culture today? And I just want to offer you another image. See that fella again, the light isn't that clear, but he's, you see anyway, he's down in the hole and he's digging. And I'll just tell you a story that kind of prompted that image for me. As far as I'm pretty much sure now that this isn't just a story; it actually happened. But in West Kerry, on the Dingle Peninsula, in some part of the Dingle Peninsula, the land was very wet, and the farmers couldn't make it productive. And they were ploughing it and they were fertilising it, but they could not get the water out of the soil. So this guy came along, a geologist of some sort, and he did a depth analysis of the soil. And what he discovered was that well down, there was a hard pan contracted soil that kind of formed like a rock-like barrier to the water escaping. And what he was saying to them was, if you actually plow down really deep, you'd break through the pan and you would revitalize the whole soil. Now, they thought he was mad, but he asked one farmer, could he get in with a digger? And the farmer let him in, and he said afterwards the only reason he let him in was he thought he'd never come out again. But sure enough, your man dug down and broke through the pan and drained the soil. And the community learned, gosh, if we actually went deeper than what we had been going, we could transform our... And that's what happened. I just think that's a lovely metaphor, because my sense is, you know, particularly in regard to the whole question of family, that we will have to dig deep. And that it's not a question of trying one thing and if it doesn't work, saying, well, they're not interested, or but staying with the question and exploring over time, are there ways? Because there's another reality I just want to there's a guy called Tom Inglis. He's a sociology man up in Dublin. He lost his wife there a few years ago, and for him, the meaning of life became, you know, a very powerful question. And one of the ways he explored it was actually talking and doing a study among people in Ireland. What's your meaning? Like, what's the most important meaning in life for you? So he conducted 100 in-depth interviews. And published the results in a book called Meanings of Life in Contemporary Ireland. And the thing that most struck him, and you see it up there again, that family life is by far and away the most important thing for Irish people. Whether they were church people or not church people, family was hugely important. And it didn't matter whether it was a kind of a standard family type or a variation on the standard. Once people were enmeshed in loving relationships, once they had the experience of being loved, and once they had the opportunity to love back, it lifted their whole lives. And whenever that was broken or blocked or frustrated, it was very devastating for their lives. So that's a huge reality that's really, really worth bearing in mind. And I think Pope Francis like in the joy of love, his burning question is, how do we bring good news to that reality? People long for a love that lasts. And that's precisely what vision of love and marriage and family that we offer, a love that lasts. And how can we offer that? There's two, I think, clues in Tom Inglis' study that are worth paying attention to. One is that, for the most part, family is something we do as people. It's not something we talk about. We don't theorize that much about families. We don't go to meetings about families, but we are very drawn to family celebrations, to family activities. And I think, as church, we are far too cerebral in how we approach our own engagement with people in that regard. If I could use a metaphor of meal and menu. Some years ago, I was working in a parish, and we were looking to engage the parents of the children starting school. And there were hundreds and hundreds of those parents. And we wanted them to know about the religion program that the children were doing in the school, the relevance of religion for the lives of the children, and how they as parents might support that. Might support their children in deepening their religious sense. So we did like what normal adult education people do. We put on a talk. We advertised it very heavily in the local radio, the papers. We sent long series letters home to all the parents, to the kids. And did many come to our talk? No, eight parents came, and I was given the talk. So, and our first response was, it was humiliating, and our first response was kind of anger. What's wrong with that crowd that won't come to what we're putting on? But after a while, it dawned on us, that's the wrong question. The real question was, what's wrong with what we're putting on that good folk are not engaged by it? You know, that was the real question. And we thought about that and said, what's important to parents? Of course, I was stupid. I had two kids that started primary school. And I knew that was a huge moment in our family life. You know, the kids now being in some place where we couldn't be as parents. And so we got to thinking, why not have a celebration of that moment, a faith celebration of that moment for the families? So we put together a package, a kind of a celebration package. We asked the teachers to help in producing a homemade video of the children in the classroom engaging with the religion program and trying to learn how to pray. And it's how we're watching four-year-olds meditate, you know, or trying to close their eyes. And so we had that. So we sent a poster home to the parents saying the kids are going to be on the big screen. We're celebrating that they're completing their first ever term in primary school. You're very welcome to come along. Bring the babies, bring the uncles, the aunts, the grandparents, whoever you like, and the brothers and sisters. And we said we would be doing a blessing of the children by their family. So we constructed a blessing service done by the family. So we would say that to the parents. We said there'd be a talk, a short talk, we said, because when the babies are screaming as they were, you're not going to howl an audience for a half an hour. Like, people weren't sitting down in neat rows like this. There were kids running everywhere. We had a good sound, loud sound system, and we were able to make more noise than they were. And we said we'd have a party, you know, as a part of the night. So that was the celebration package. And did it come to that? Yeah. It did, yeah. Yeah. 800 adults came. So one approach, 8. The other approach, 800. And it goes back to the metaphor of the meal and the menu. If you invite people to a meal, and if you're very, you know, if you organize it well, that there's a lovely warm reception, there's good food, there's a festive atmosphere, folk would be delighted to come. If you invited the same folk to a discussion about the menu, you know, there'd be a few who'd be really into the biology of cooking. But most folk are much more interested in eating food than having a conversation about it. Do you know? And it's the same. Like, the communication of faith is much, like, the experience, the heart is fierce important. And we engage people, and that's what your man is saying there. Family is something we do rather than theorize about. Now, that doesn't mean you ignore the head, but you bring the head to the heart rather than vice versa. And then the other thing that he said, and I suppose this goes back to the metaphor of digging, he says, when he was talking to people about their family life and their love and so on, the thing that really struck him was they never talked about faith. They never spoke about their family commitment, their love, or anything in terms of faith. Even the Orthodox Catholics, that was the term he used for people who were regular church goers in his sample, even those did not speak the language of faith when they talked about their love. And he was saying, Tom Inglis is saying, that there's a gap between our language and the language that people use. And that in his interview, he wasn't able to get deep enough into people's experience to see whether there was faith there or not. But Harry Bohan, I was at another gathering there quite recently, and Harry was talking about a family gathering, a bit like our own, the one I described. And he gathered parents around drawings that their children had done about really happy moments in their family life. So the kids were invited to draw pictures that expressed something of what was beautiful for them in their family life. And Harry gathered the parents around the pictures. And he said he had no bother getting people to talk in faith language. You know, that it was like that deep digging that I talked about earlier, that there is a depth, there is a grace in the culture. But we as church are not... our present means aren't able to access it for the most part. You know, I'm not saying nothing works, but and I suppose my own sense is that I think Pope Francis is challenging us to go deeper, and to be confident that we can bring something and we can find something when we go deeper.